Okay, April greetings and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute Friday evening lecture series. I'm Anthony Wong, program coordinator of the Institute. Thank you very much for coming out on this beautiful Friday evening. For our talk tonight, Marriage Unbound, State Law, Power and Inequality in Contemporary China by Professor Ke Li. Ke Li is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Her research focuses on law, legal professions, courts, and women's rights in China. She is the author of Marriage Unbound, published by Stanford University Press in 2002, and that is available to purchase online for $30. I dropped the link into the chat for those of you online here, and those of you just go to the talk webpage and you'll find the link. The book has received awards from the Law and Society Association, the American Political Science Association, and the American Sociological Association, respectively. Also, on Monday, May 6th, the Institute is co-sponsoring a program on LGBTQ resilience in China, organized by the China CUNY Initiative, together with Professor Li. We'll be screening the documentary Happily Ever After, and then we will have a discussion with the director, Xiao Peihe, and lawyer Xiaoying Dong. We hope you can join us for that event, and the link is also available on our website, and if you sign up for our newsletter, you'll receive the e-blast later on. With that, please welcome Professor Ke Li.
Anthony, thank you for helping me organize this event, and given what happened this morning, I thought the Asian American Asian Research Institute would probably cancel the event, but who would, because I figured, who would show up at an event like this after a major earthquake? And here you are. So I'm just really glad you come. And I should quickly point out my book, Marriage Unbound, State Law, Power and Inequality in Contemporary China, it actually came out in 2022, not 2000. Anthony misspoke. And so the book, after the book came out roughly 2 years ago, it occurred to me that it took me a very long time to realize that divorce in contemporary China is so much more than dissolution of marriage between two individuals or two families. And in fact, at the heart of this book is a conviction that divorce provides a unique window onto the phenomenon of great importance to political scientists, sociologists, social legal researchers, and China scholars. So today I will just flesh out this idea that divorce is a lot more than just the termination of a marriage. Let me first start with a divorce case involving someone named Wang Guiping. On a blistering hot summer day, I ran into Wang Guiping, a rural woman in her late 40s. For a decade or so, Guiping eked out a living as a migrant worker in China's booming urban economies. Her world during those years was divided between a family life in a Western inland village and cash-paying factory jobs in a southeast coastal city. While Guiping migrated to cities to look for a farm employment, her husband, He Jun, stayed in the village, taking care of the young and the elderly in the family. Their marriage would survive separation across time and space. Guiping had thought so. After all, the couple used to be two lovebirds. By the time I met Guiping in the summer of 2010, that past seemed all the more remote. In fact, her husband of two decades had been carrying on marital affairs with another woman for months. Worse, he had moved in with his girlfriend. He had brought her to a few family gatherings, and he had violently, physically and verbally attacked his wife, threatening to kill Wang Guiping on the spot. Despite Guiping's efforts to mend her relationship with her husband, her marriage fell apart bit by bit. On July 14, 2010, that was the day I met Guiping for the first time. She was waiting for her divorce trial at a local court. By taking her husband to court, She expected to end a hopeless relationship and to realize her rights as a wife, a property owner. Later that day, Gui Ping would find herself betrayed not only by her husband, but also by the court system and her own legal counsel. Eventually, she would get a divorce, but at a price she had never imagined. So here I should emphasize that Wang Guiping's experiences in marriage and then in divorce are neither unique nor random. Rather, these experiences mirror large-scale trends that have been unfolding in contemporary China. In this talk, I draw on Guiping and other women's divorce cases to highlight several themes as the heart of my book. First, I will discuss how women's participation in labor migration has reshaped Chinese family and marriage. Next, I will lay out an argument. Wang Guiping and many other Chinese women, compared to their mothers and grandmothers, are more likely to seek out judicial remedies for conjugal grievances and conflicts. This trend, which I call the judicialization of marital disputes, is no coincidence. It rather reflects the historical trajectory along which the People's Republic of China, or the PRC as a shorthand. The PRC has refined its governing methodologies in the context of dispute resolution and beyond. Stated otherwise, that women increasingly turn to litigation for official interventions attest to the PRC's decades-long efforts to weave legality into the fabric of its ruling. Finally, I will explain why rural women like Wang Guiping often walk away from their divorce litigation with little or no marital property, child support, or any remedies for domestic violence and spousal abandonment, which is to say I will provide an account of how or why and why divorce litigation often reproduces gender inequality in family and in society at large. In short, I will unfold this talk along three lines: the linkage between labor migration and marital instability in China, the intricate interplay of law and politics in authoritarian state, and power and inequality within and outside Chinese courts. To my colleagues, in the sociology of family, Marriage on Bond features a close look at how decades of massive rural to urban migration have reshaped Chinese family and marriage. I should emphasize that Wang Guiping is among the millions of Chinese women hailing from the countryside and subsequently making their entry into the country's rapidly expanding metropolitan areas. According to the National Bureau of Statistics, over the past four decades, about 288 million rural residents have turned themselves into migrant workers, also known as China's floating population. During this time period, women have consistently made up roughly one-third of this floating population. Essentially, this is to say that about 95 million Chinese women have joined the journey from the countryside to the various urban destinations. Today, women of rural origin can be found in various labor-intensive industries, from manufacturing to transportation, from construction work to the service sector. While more women migrate to cities and towns, China has seen a very dramatic surge in divorce in recent decades. I have a figure to illustrate this trend. Between 1978 and 2018, the number of marriages dissolved by courts annually rose fourfold, jumping from 140,000 to more than 648,000. Meanwhile, the volume of divorce approved by local governments soared from approximately 170,000 to 3.8 million. And here I should provide some background information. In China, there are two routes people can take to legally terminate their marriages. If a divorce is uncontested, the couple can register their divorce at a local government. On the other hand, if a couple cannot agree on the dissolution of their marriage, or they have disagreements on allocation of child custody or division of property, conjugal property, one or two can go to the court to file a divorce lawsuit. So this is why you see two measures in this figure. Drawing on findings from 80 interviews with women and men on the verge of divorce, I connect the dots between labor migration and marital instability in Chinese society. In the interest of time, I will focus on one couple's experience to show how labor migration gravely complicates average women and men's intimate lives and often give rise to marital grievances and even divorce. Yuan Yue, a migrant woman in her late 30s, had dreamed about running her own restaurant in a big city like Chengdu. Her husband, Fang Bing, did not share that aspiration, nor did he support his wife's pursuit of a career in food service. Rather, he was skeptical about her dream from day one. "He didn't want me to make any friends, even when I hung out with female friends," he complained, "as if he didn't want me to meet anyone out there," Yuan Yue said, and she said so during an interview, recalling her husband's reactions to her work outside the village. Outgoing and sociable, Yuan Yue ignored her husband's reactions and went on to build a social circle of her own, dining out with co-workers, playing mahjong with friends at tea houses, and going on trips into nature. Her husband, however, harbored a very different view. Nothing good could come out of those social activities, and that was his conclusion. Time went by. The friction between the couple grew more heated. Yuan Yue remembered one incident in particular. Waiting outside her restaurant, Fang Bing, the husband, spotted his wife chatting with a waiter almost a decade her junior. "You know what he said to me afterwards?" Yuan Yue asked rhetorically during the interview. Later that day, Fang Bing confronted his wife, accusing her of indulging herself in extramarital affairs with a much younger man. That accusation, unsurprisingly, did not sit well with Yuan Yue. It scarred the couple's relationship, and the wounds it had left behind never healed. When friction escalated into skirmishes, skirmishes into battles, and battles into ruthless ravage, their marriage reached a breaking point. Stalking his wife all day long, Fang Bing finally caught her drinking tea with another man at a tea house. Although Yuan Yue and her friend repeatedly explained the nature of their relationship, Fang Bing remained convinced that his wife was cheating on her. Shortly after, he summoned other family members and exposed Yuan Yue's so-called adultery. Those acts, in the eyes of country folks, amounted to public shaming and condemnation. "He drove me into a corner," said Yuan Yue. "How could I possibly live with him after that?" Eventually, Yuan Yue took her husband to court and asked for a divorce. A court ruling put an end to their 17-year relationship in 2011. Using this divorce case as an example, I show that on the one hand, women's participation in the urban labor force extends their day-to-day interactions with men outside the home. Many women take the opportunity to acquaint themselves with male co-workers, to befriend migrant men from other regions, and to build friendly or even intimate relationships outside marriage. Labor migration, in that sense, offers women not only much-needed financial independence, but also fresh opportunities to reimagine and rearrange intimacy and marriage. In the meantime, as women embark on labor migration, their significant others must adapt to new living arrangements. Men in the countryside, however, do not always find these arrangements bearable or imaginable. Out of anxiety, jealousy, and perhaps profound disorientation, some men resort to extreme measures, such as stalking, physical confrontation, and various forms of abuses in order to cling onto relationships increasingly susceptible to new desires and aspirations. Indeed, throughout the interviews, and I should quickly note, I conducted 80 interviews with 32 women. And in those interviews, time and again, I heard women lamenting their husband's distrust, suspicion, and flat-out accusations of infidelity. Men's misadaptation to labor migration, in other words, often lead to conjugal tensions, disputes, and even marital dissolution. In Chapter 2, in Marriage Unbound, I unpack the intricate linkage between labor migration and marital instability. Readers interested in Chinese family and marriage may find that chapter particularly relevant. In this way, Marriage Unbound represents a thoughtful response to two bodies of scholarship. For a good part of the 20th century, demographers, economists, sociologists treated women's increasing labor force participation largely as an economical phenomenon with implications manifest either in the workplace or in the labor market. Very few researchers look beyond the workplace or the labor market. And when they did explore the connections between female employment and marital instability, many researchers settled with an instrumentalist view. That is, they generally considered women's labor force participation as instrumental for their attempts to break away from unhappy marriages. To put it another way, very few researchers explicitly examine how women themselves understood their labor force participation or its impact on domestic lives. A similar problem stands out among anthropologists, sociologists, geographers who, on the turn of the 21st century, started examining Chinese women's experiences in internal migration. As researchers turn their critical gaze to women's daily struggles in the urban labor force, few researchers look beyond the factory floors, assembly lines, or massive dormitories to examine migrant workers' experiences or struggles in intimate relationships. Marriage Unbound fills a gap in these two bodies of literature by capturing women's efforts to connect migration of farm employment and the ups and downs in their family lives. To political scientists and sociologists, Marriage Unbound, I hope, offers a new perspective on the complex interplay of law and politics in an authoritarian context. Since the late 70s, more women have turned to the court system for official intervention in domestic lives. This trend, I argue, is part of a larger historical trajectory. Along this trajectory, the PRC, once a revolutionary regime, then a socialist one, and today post-socialist, has continued to streamline its governing methodologies. Using various archival records, I show that throughout the history of the PRC, women and men unhappy about their family lives did not always go to the court for remedies instead wives and husbands. In the Maoist era, in the socialist period, and then in the 21st century, have developed drastically different experiences in dispute resolution and in political participation. More specifically, in the Maoist era, so this is between 49 to 76, that's how I define the Maoist era, PRC's ruling elites mostly relied on mass campaigns, or also known as 群众运动 in Chinese, used mass campaigns as a dominant mode for the state to interfere with citizens' intimate relationships. In the early socialist period, roughly from the late 70s to the late 1990s, mass campaigns give way to people's mediation, also known as 人民调解. And finally, a decade into the 21st century, top decision makers arrived at a new realization. The PRC must establish a multi-pronged system for dispute resolution, and this system comprises litigation, people's mediation, or xingfang, sometimes translated as letters and visits, and other official measures. All these measures strive to dispel popular contention, preempt social unrest, and safeguard citizens' rights in some, but in not other domains. Due to time constraints, I won't get into the specifics about mass campaign in the Maoist era or the people's mediation in the socialist period. During the Q&A, I'd be happy to offer more information about these two state intervention, modes of state interventions. Here, let me just quickly sum up some of the most important takeaways. The fact that the PRC in the 21st century has increasingly relied on litigation to address citizens' marital grievances and rights claims, I argue, should not be treated as evidence indicative of an authoritarian regime's turn toward law. Similarly, the PRC's ruling elites have recently shored up quasi-judicial or extrajudicial measures such as the people's mediation. Such efforts should not be viewed as proof suggestive of an authoritarian regime's turn against the law. Put it more plainly, the PRC in recent two decades did not turn toward or against law categorically, as some of my colleagues have contended. Rather, the PRC has been weaving legality into the fabric of governance by juxtaposing legality with, not pitting legality against, extra-legal practices, institutions, and ruling methods. In recent years, policymakers, in fact, have simultaneously enhanced judicial, quasi-judicial, and extrajudicial institutions by and large in hopes that they can deploy different institutions to tackle different types of popular grievances. In this fashion, the regime has cultivated a multi-pronged system for dispute resolution. I know this sounds very abstract, so let me offer some concrete empirical details. So what has been going on in the past two decades is that officially designated mundane or frequent disputes, so the Chinese phrase, 常见性多发性纠纷. Those mundane and frequent disputes, such as marital disputes and torts, these disputes have often been pushed into the courts in the name of the socialist rule of law. In the meantime, difficult hot bottom disputes, the official phrase used for this case is 难点热点纠纷. For instance, widespread discontent with land taking, demolition, labor relations, and medical malpractice disputes. Those difficult top-bottom disputes are often channeled into quasi-judicial or extrajudicial bureaucracies for the sake of social stability. Essentially, this is to say that the state has funneled different type of disputes into different type of institutions. Under Xi Jinping's watch, these measures taken together have been branded as efforts to diversify dispute resolution. The Chinese phrase is 多元化纠纷解决. These developments, I argue, suggest that the PRC should be analyzed as a case. This is an example of an authoritarian regime calibrating and recalibrating its governing methods. And it has done so by juxtaposing ruling methodologies, some inherited from the PRC's past and others borrowed from liberal democracies. And so essentially this is to say that the PRC's ruling elites have strategically and selectively tapped into diverse cultural traditions. These traditions include but not limited to the country's real or imagined roots in Confucianism, the Maoist past, socialist legacies, and foreign influences, especially influences, ruling experiences borrowed from liberal democracies. By weaving legality and extra-legality into its ruling, by mobilizing judicial, quasi-judicial, and extra-judicial ruling methods, the PRC strive to craft more or less novel solutions to emerging problems in ruling. This pragmatism, on the one hand, makes the regime quite resourceful and resilient. And on the other hand, when the PRC's ruling elites treat legality and extra-legality, you know, you have judicial methods, you also have extrajudicial methods, you use different methods to treat to solve different problems. When you treat legality and extra legality as if they were so malleable and mixable, you can just mix up all different ruling methodologies. When you do that, there are unintended consequences. To fully untangle these two sides of the PRC's legal developments, I invite readers to read chapters 3 and 4. This is where I articulate a key takeaway of the book. That is, if we want to understand why the PRC as an authoritarian regime has been so resilient and so adaptable, we need to understand how autocrats from time to time get stuck. Sometimes they are very resourceful. They know how to appropriate ruling experience, ruling methods from different sources. But other times autocrats can get stuck in policy wrangling. Sometimes for years they couldn't really figure out how to proceed in reforms. To get at the heart of these different, the two different aspects of authoritarian politics, we should pay greater attention to the complex interplay of culture and the state. So this is the second part of the book. Finally, to sociolegal researchers, Marjane Bond features a serious attempt to unravel power and inequality in China and beyond. Let me go back to Wang Guiping's divorce case, the woman I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. On July 14, 2010, a judge ruled over this lawsuit. Eventually, Wang Guiping got a divorce, but she had to sign away all her property rights. By contrast, her husband not only retained the couple's joint property, but also dodged legal consequences for his conduct. Neither the judge nor Wang Guiping's legal counsel investigated whether the husband's behavior, for example, he physically assaulted his wife, he cohabitated with another woman during his marriage. Neither the judge nor Wang Guiping's legal counsel looked into those behaviors and decide if the husband's conduct constitute domestic violence, bigamy, or spousal abandonment. All of these are codified offenses according to Chinese law. In Chapter 7, I detailed how the presiding judge in this case pressured Wang Guiping into divorce settlements, forcing her to give up her marital property and ignored her complaints about domestic violence. Over the years, I've seen many women enter divorce litigation and expect fairness, equity down the road. The majority, I should note, that only had their notions of justice, fairness, and equity been gutted in the end. Put it more plainly, Wang Guiping's courtroom experiences are anything but exceptional. Using a sample of 198 divorce cases, I show in detail how poorly women, compared to their male counterparts, failed in the grassroots court system. Most of the women in my book eventually walked away from their divorce lawsuits with little or no marital property, child support, or judicial remedies for domestic violence, spousal abandonment, or even marital rape. Their husband, by stark contrast, managed to hold on to child custody, conjugal property, and those responsible for adultery and spousal abuses, invariably emerged unscathed from their encounters with the law. In short, divorce litigation produced stark gender inequalities. To explain why women often end up receiving the short end of the stick, I argue that social legal researchers should reconceive the concept of dispute resolution. Accordingly, I introduced a power-centered framework. And using this framework, I show how and why women often emerged as losers at the end of divorce litigation. So the first type of power I introduce in the book, it's called formal decision-making power. It refers to the type of power judges exercise to determine who prevail over the resolution of overt conflicts. And essentially, this is to say that this is the type of power judges use to determine who gets divorced, who doesn't, and who obtains what at the end of a marriage. Using court rulings as a primary data source, I show that judges more often than not sided with husbands as opposed to wives. In exercising formal decision-making power, judges routinely, for example, favor husbands over wives, assigning child custody to the former at the expense of the latter's lawful rights. Similarly, judges often block women's attempts to challenge male dominance in property possession. And even worse, judges time and again suppress women's painstaking complaints to confront domestic violence. So in my sample, out of 198 cases, 97 women explicitly complained about domestic violence. And some even managed to submit copious evidence suggesting that they did suffer from various forms of domestic violence, and in the end, judges failed to hold any man responsible for such offenses. And the second type of power here refers to the type of power legal professionals or judges exercise to delimit the scope of official decision-making, and they do so by excluding certain issues or participants from entering formal court proceedings. One telling example is the power legal professionals exercise So in my fieldwork, I observed how legal professionals in the countryside responded, how they reacted to women's rights claims. So when female divorce litigants met with their attorneys, oftentimes women insisted that they must have child custody, or at the end of their marriage, they should obtain certain amount or certain shares of their conjugal property, not to mention that frequently women complained about their experiences as victims of domestic violence. And what happened in those face-to-face meetings between male legal professionals and female clients is that legal professionals often fail to convert women's complaints into formal rights claims. So when you don't even write down those complaints, when you don't translate these complaints into rights claims, these complaints fell through the cracks long before they could even reach the courthouse. And here's one more example I can use to illustrate how not only legal professionals exercise agenda-setting power, in fact, judges also exercise agenda-setting power. This is in Chinese courts, especially in civil litigation. When a plaintiff is willingly to drop her complaints and her rights claims, a judge can conclude her case through a procedure called withdrawal. And what this figure illustrates is that from 1974 all the way to 2018, the portion of divorce petitions that ended in withdrawal jumped from 5% to 25%. Practically what this means is for every four divorce lawsuits that made their way to Chinese courts, one out of the four ended in withdrawal. So this is to say that increasingly Chinese judges relied on withdrawal to dispose of civil lawsuits in general and divorce lawsuits in particular. Of course, in theory, if this happens when a plaintiff willingly drops her lawsuit, that there's nothing wrong about it. But in reality, what frequently happens is that judges pressure rural women to withdraw their divorce petitions and concluded their cases through withdrawal. And what this means in reality is that this trend, in upward trend, has a very explicit gender implication, because throughout the country, roughly 70% of divorce lawsuits are initiated by women, not by men. So when judges force plaintiffs to withdraw their lawsuits and drop all their claims, this means that it is women who are blocked out of access. It's women who lose their access to justice as opposed to men. In that sense, the wide use of withdrawal has a very distinct gendered consequence. And in my book, I draw on both ethnographic and archival evidence to show that Chinese judges have been legally, organizationally, and politically incentivized to use and very likely overuse and abuse withdrawal in divorce litigation and beyond. In so doing, judges have a lot to gain and little to lose in their everyday practice of law. And of course, as I just quickly point out, judges' preference withdrawal has generated very negative consequences for women. And this means, more often than not, judges end up blocking women's access, not men's access to justice. ultimately it is women, not men, who bear the brunt of judges' likes and dislikes. Let me go back to the previous slide. Finally, I introduce the third type of power relationships, which I call conscious formation power. And this type of power refers to the reality that power holders often rely on ideological indoctrination, acculturation, and other cultural mechanisms to instill consent and compliance in these empowered groups such as rural women. And the corresponding example in my book is the power policy makers at multiple levels have exercised in shaping what women can conceivably demand at the end of their marriage. In Chapter 7, I analyze how women like Wang Guiping, for example, they often vehemently contest their spousal, property, and even custodial rights upon divorce, and yet these women often remain silent on their lawful entitlement to landholding. So that was the empirical puzzle as a heart of the last chapter. How come women were so brave? They were so vocal. They insisted that they must have child custody, marital property, and when they suffer from domestic violence, they were not afraid to speak up in front of judges, and yet these women often said nothing about their lawful rights as land users. So that was the empirical puzzle I tried to address in the final chapter. And to answer, to shed light on this empirical puzzle, I basically argue that to answer this question, you really have to take a very close look at the rural land regime in China. After years, decades of policy making and lawmaking, it becomes so hard for women to not only talk about or to act upon land rights. In fact, it becomes almost unthinkable for women to contest their land rights upon divorce. So essentially, this is to say that when power is so unequally distributed, when this problem has been going on for so long, it becomes so embodied, so entrenching reality, it becomes almost impossible to people to imagine the alternative, the other course of action. So in the end, my argument is that contesting women, contesting their land rights, is not only unactionable or unspeakable, it becomes unthinkable. That's why so many rural women remain silent on their land holding in divorce lawsuits. Let me circle back and reiterate this idea. Divorce, seen through certain conceptual lens, can generate new perspectives useful for sociologists, political scientists, social-legal researchers, and China scholars. So in this book, what I try to do is to use women's experiences in legal mobilization and rights contention to shed new lights on law and politics, culture and the state, and power and inequality. So theoretically speaking, these are the keywords as the heart of my work. And methodologically, I should point out, in this book, I combine two different research methods, ethnography and historiography. My hope is by combining, by synthesizing these two research methods, I can seamlessly weave ethnographic and archival evidence into the fabric of book writing. In doing so, I situate Chinese women's present-day lived experiences in larger historical context and therefore connect the dots between the present and the past, between the mundane, the microscopic on one side, and far-reaching social-economical changes in Chinese society on the other. And finally, let me quickly say something about my experimentation with feature writing. To make this book more readable, I went to CUNY School of Journalism to study feature writing. So this is a genre mostly used by investigative journalists. And so in this book, from time to time, you will find my writing a bit like the kind of feature story you read in magazines. And I hope this experimentation will give readers a sense of how social scientists can benefit from journalistic, basically creative, nonfiction creative writing. Together, taken together, Marriage on Bond demonstrates how a study of divorce, as I said, divorce may seem very prosaic, very mundane. Turns out a study of divorce can forge new ground for theory building, methodological innovation, and the practice of writing. Sure, please go ahead.
Walk through the logic of why the judges would prefer withdrawal, like what are some like benefits they get and things like that?
Sure, that's a really good question. And so there are several reasons why judges generally prefer withdrawal. One, when judges pressure plaintiffs to withdraw their cases, right? Judges don't have to make any substantive decisions. They don't have to look into women's complaints about domestic violence. They don't have to investigate who should have which part of conjugal property. So in that sense, withdrawal as a civil procedure allows judges to save both time and judicial resources. So this is the first. And the second one is when judges settle or conclude cases through withdrawal, litigants, both the plaintiff and the defendant, cannot really challenge this decision. You cannot go to the appellate court and say, oh, judges made a mistake, and I'm here to overturn the judge's ruling, because Chinese law does not allow litigants to challenge judge's decision in withdrawal. Essentially, this is to say that judges could lower the risk or even remove the risk of having their decisions overturned by a higher court. And finally, there's a political aspect of withdrawal. The wide use of withdrawal is since early 2000, Chinese authorities have put more and more emphasis on the so-called harmonious socialist society, right? And how do you create a harmonious society? You want to lower the rates of lawsuits. So judges have been pressured to use withdrawal and mediation rather than adjudication to dispose cases. So essentially, this is to say that court administrators use rates of withdrawal as a metric to measure judges' performance. So if you can settle or if you can dispose most of the cases in your court through withdrawal, you get a higher score. But if your colleagues couldn't really do that, they may end up with a lower score. So both bureaucratically, organizationally, and politically, and I should also quickly point out, legally speaking, judges are incentivized to use withdrawal to conclude cases.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you so much.
Sure.
How do you recruit the target? And also, how do you conduct the interview?
These days, I don't think I can do this study. So I started this project around 2000, in the summer of 2006. That was the first time I took a trip to visit a rural county in southern Sichuan province. And then in the summer of 2007, summer of 2008, I went back to the same rural county to build connections, to build ties with judges, legal professionals, village cadres, and local government officials. Basically, it took me 3 summers to secure my access to the local court system, and most importantly, to secure access to 2 legal workers' offices. And by the way, in rural China, there are so few law firms. Lawyers are quite rare, at least in that part of Sichuan province. So what peasants had to do in order to access legal services is that they went to legal workers' offices. The Chinese term is called 基层法律服务所, as opposed to law firms, to seek out legal assistance or legal services. And legal workers, by the way, is just a different type of legal profession in rural China. Legal workers generally have less formal training, less professional prestige, and less formal legal education, but they are just like lawyers. They basically provide legal services in charge for fees. So what I did was I managed to access two legal workers' offices. So from January 2010 to May 2011, I spent 17 months in that rural county to observe how judges interact with divorce litigants and how legal workers interacted with their clients.
So you were sitting in the court?
Yeah, literally sitting in the court observing how judges handle divorce cases. And so many times I literally sit in legal workers' office to observe, to document, and then to analyze how legal professionals responded to their clients' complaints and rights claims. So that's how I managed to recruit 12 rural men on the verge of divorce and then 30... Sorry, I misspoke earlier today. I actually recruited 36 rural women, not 32, 36 rural women who were thinking about divorce or who had already initiated divorce litigation. So it was a lot. Yeah, that's why it takes 15 years to produce this book.
Another question. You showed a chart at the beginning. The divorce based on two different mechanisms.
Yes.
What's the underlying rationale for the difference? One is the exponentially growing, the other one is basically plateau, right?
Yeah, you asked a really good question because these two mechanisms, right? Either if your divorce is uncontested, let's say if a husband and wife both agree on the dissolution of their marriage, they agreed on child custody and division of conjugal property, they can just go to the local government to register their divorce, right? So that's that's considered as a uncontested divorce. But on the other hand, if a couple cannot agree on all those terms, then one person or both parties may end up in court. That's considered as a contested divorce.
Could you explain the trend?
Sure. So I think the most interesting thing happened.
For example, what happened in 1997?
1997?
Yeah.
Why did you ask about that?
Because it's growing slowly, but
yeah.
Then it's basically quite
I think this is the cutting point.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
I should explain.
Oh, yeah, right.
What happened in 2003 was that the State Council, Guoyuan, revised the marital registration regulation. Before 2003, for couples to register their divorces, they must first get their employer's permission if they were urban residents. If they were peasants, they must get their approval, from village kendries. Essentially, this is to say that you cannot really dissolve your own marriage without your employers or your village leaders' approval. And that regulation was recanted in 2003. After that point, Chinese couples could bypass local authorities and register their divorce. So 2003 was really the turning point. Essentially, that means that after 2003, Chinese citizens could bypass the state altogether and decided on their own divorce.
Is that a good thing or bad?
I would consider that's a good thing, right? Yeah, why do you want your employer's word on your marriage, right? So, Yes.
I was interested to learn more about how the judges come to the verdicts that they come to, right? As China is a civil law country, I would assume that there is a set of rules and regulations as to how they're supposed to divide assets, how they're supposed to entertain these different types of claims. So is it that the system that they have is set up in a very foolhardy way or a very misogynistic way that it results consistently in these bad outcomes? Mm-hmm. Or is it set up in a, let's say, more enlightened way from a liberal democracy, but the judges are consistently misapplying it, either intentionally or unintentionally?
I think the second scenario is closer to what I have seen in my research. Basically, this is to say that Chinese law, right? If you just look at the legal rules, norms on the books, Chinese law is ostensibly gender neutral. Or you may even say that Chinese lawmakers over the decades have actually put consistent emphasis on the importance of protecting women and children's lawful rights. Again, we're just talking about the law on the books, right? And so I wouldn't describe Chinese law as misogynistic or biased against women. But when you look at law in action or law in practice, what's actually going on inside the court system, it's a very different story. So that's why, as a social legal scholar, my main job is to explain the gap, right? The gap between law on the books and law in action. And turns out this is a huge gap.
Right. So can you talk about how do judges understand that law or not understand that law? Or is it more that there's corruption between the different elements of the legal services profession where they just don't know or don't care enough and they're sort of covering each other? In this situation, can you sort of walk us through how the law is not being applied?
Sure. So in principle, judges should follow one criteria in deciding on divorce cases. And the main criterion is the breakdown of mutual affections. If a judge finds that mutual affection between a husband and wife has collapsed, then in theory, in principle, the judges should rule and terminate the marriage in question. So this is just about marital dissolution, right? And when it comes to the division of conjugal property, again, in principle, is that Chinese courts or Chinese law firmly believes that men and women should be equal, that when it comes to the division of conjugal property, sometimes judges should even not necessarily favor, but rule in favor of the economically less advantaged party, meaning that if a wife could suffer from economical hardship after divorce, then judges should take that into consideration and assign a bigger share of conjugal property to the wife. And when it comes to child custody, China, like many other countries, follows the principle of the child's best interest. And there are, of course, more detailed stipulations about what you should do as a judge if the child in question is younger than two, what happens if the child is between 10 years old. Once the child is older than 10, you can ask a child for his or her or their own preference. So all this is to say that, again, if we just look at formal legal rules and norms, they're quite fair. You may even say progressive. But in reality, it's a very, very different story. In the countryside, women are often considered as outsiders in their own conjugal communities. And this is the case in part because till this day, in rural China, women still follow this patrilineal, patrilocal practice, meaning that when you get married, you relocate from your own natal family to your conjugal family, from your natal village to your conjugal village. So this means that once you marry into your husband's family, right, within his family, within his community, you're considered as an outsider. This makes it incredibly difficult for women to gather evidence about spousal abandonment, domestic violence. So many women in my study told me that, oh, of course my neighbor, my village leaders knew that I had suffered from domestic violence, but who would testify on behalf of me in court? You know, right? Your neighbors wouldn't want to alienate your own in-laws, the insiders. And women's extended participation in labor migration, when women spend months, years outside their village working elsewhere, their participation in labor migration often further dilutes their connections with their conjugal villages. So in fact, in several interviews, when I ask women, hey, upon divorce, did you approach your village leaders and ask for help? They were like, I don't even know who served as my village, you know, party secretary, who was the leader of the village anymore, because I spent years working elsewhere. So, and finally, I should point out, inside Chinese courts, judges these days are so acutely aware of social stability, or another term is stability maintenance, weiwen. So when you have a large number of women leaving their own conjugal communities, working elsewhere, men who stay in the village become very anxious. And not to mention, here's another backstory, is that China has seen highly skewed sex ratio. I believe one statistic suggests that around 2025, there will be roughly 20 million Chinese men who could not find wives. And so this is to say, I remember when I did my field work, virtually every village I visited, villagers told me, I can count a certain number of men who had never been married, who just couldn't find a bride. And this is also why human trafficking was actually very, very serious in that part of Sichuan province. So judges, by the way, were all acutely aware of those social problems. So imagine two individuals show up in your court. The wife wants a divorce. The husband doesn't, in part because he knows that it's highly unlikely for him to find another spouse to have his own offspring down the road. And when this repeatedly happens, and judges have to think about the social consequences of dissolving marriages and ruling in favor of women. So what do judges typically did is they try to sacrifice women's conjugal rights, property rights, in order to appease their men so wives and husbands could reach divorce settlements. I guess that was the main rationale behind judges' efforts to sacrifice, to violate women's property rights and custodial rights. Yes,
and we have a couple of online questions.
Oh, sure.
Lisa Sun says, women's rights seem to be violated in so many ways, and in the case of divorce litigation, here in the U.S., we also see extraordinary hardships, both economically and emotionally, inflicted on women, regardless of financial or educational background. Today, even reading about high-profile divorces of celebrities such as Brad Pitt, we're seeing a questionable balance of power between the wife and the husband. How can we, as members of society, not just under any type of political system, craft laws that reflect the needs and aspirations of women across the world?
Well, that's a big question. One thing I've seen repeatedly in my studies that rural women, especially those who got stuck in unhappy relationships, unhappy marriages, oftentimes these women were so isolated. They were socially isolated, and they could not form any collective action. And the absence of NGOs, the absence of civil society, only made it harder for women to mobilize and to obtain resources, or, for example, legal assistance they desperately needed. So I think one important takeaway from my research is the importance of civil society, the importance of NGOs, organizations that can advocate on behalf of women, NGOs that can advocate for women's rights and lawful interests. So that's one important thing. And another one is, Yes, law, to social legal scholars, we know very well that law is not always the weapon of the weak. Sometimes law, legal mobilization, even litigation, can end up reproducing inequality and injustice. Despite that, I want to quickly point out as an individual level, when people are well informed of their rights, when people firmly believe that they are legally entitled, they are much more likely to use law to their advantage. So I would say at the societal level, we need to empower civil society and ensure that NGOs can advocate for women. And as an individual level, I would encourage more people to learn their own rights and learn how to mobilize law as a tool to address their grievances and to access judicial remedies.
Okay, and then we have one last question. Professor Su-Ming Lee, sociology at Hunter College, asks, the cases you mentioned are mostly rural, urban, floating population.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any cases of women who are Chinese minorities or with religious groups whose marriage quote-unquote law was affected by not only the law, but also religious practice?
Oh, that's a really good question. Unfortunately, in my study, I didn't really examine minority groups. And so virtually every single woman I interviewed, the women I studied, were Han Chinese. So I don't really know if or how religion may have played a role shaping women's experience of legal mobilization.
Thank you, Professor Lee, for a wonderful talk. You can purchase Marriage Unbound, State Law, Power and Inequality in Contemporary China for $30 online through the link on tonight's talk webpage. Reminder, once again, May 6th, we're doing the talk on LGBTQ resilience in China. Please join us for that. Enjoy the rest of your Friday evening. Remember to be an upstander if you see a fellow person in need, and good night. Thank you.